morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Chuck Yeager, considered the most famous test pilot ever, who was the first to break the sound barrier 73 years ago in 1947, and was the right stuff model for America's first astronauts, died on this year's 79th anniversary of Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, at age 91. He was a combat air ace in World War II. Today, December 17th, 10 days after his death, is the 117th anniversary of humanity's first powered flight, which is the main subject of today's program, and which I should acknowledge is a repeat performance from the last time this weekly radio rant was on today's date that lauds the historical elevation of a few North Carolina sand dunes. I am the author of the following, which is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all the humanly unexplored cosmos. I call it 30 Seconds Over Armageddon. And a quote from Mark Twain, "We shan't have to leave our fortress now when we want to blow up civilization." Without the presence of insects or birds, humanity might not have thought of flying through the air, though perhaps even without these, the simple act of falling to the ground could well have been inspiration for flight. The first attempts to swim through the sky imitated birds. Blotchy old films of some of these tries, men jumping from cliffs, flapping artificial wings attached to their arms or backs, strange homemade contraptions that usually crashed, seem funny now, but recorded real tragedy in visually eloquent pain, sometimes death, as well as failed or misapplied concepts of aerodynamics. By the time Wilbur and Orville Wright successfully flew the first engine-powered airplane 117 years ago today, the striving to attain free flight above the Earth had developed balloons and gliders. Practical gas engines designed by Benz and Daimler provided the motive breakthrough. At Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, December 17, 1903, the Wright brothers flew the first true airplane, which they named simply Flyer. Orville Wright piloted the motorized glider a few feet over sand dunes on a windswept beach and raised human beings on wings of their own. Those wings have developed more rapidly in the past century and nearly two decades than any other human invention. Supersonic jets, space rockets, intercontinental missiles, robotic drones are far removed from the flimsy generation of flying machines spawned by the Wright brothers' success. Within only a few years, warplanes were hurtling into the skies. Powered flight developed in many directions, but it has been as an agent of warfare that has made the past century the bloodiest battle age in history. The bomber in particular has accounted for the slaughter of more victims than a hundredfold of previous eras. Francisco Lana di Terze wrote in 1670 his vision of fleets of aerial machines that could fly over cities and drop vast numbers of missiles down upon defenseless citizens below. On October 23, 1911, the first bombs were dropped from such machines over Tripoli during the Italo-Turkish War. The Turks protested the war crime of a bombed hospital. Aerial bombardment developed during World War I from reconnaissance flying. If an enemy could be seen, he might as well be bombed. Strategic bombing, or the psychological destruction of civilian fortitude, came afterward, first with the great German Zeppelin raids on London. For most of the war, the belligerents concentrated primarily on tactical bombing, which meant of each other's soldiers. The first long-range heavy bomber raids were made by the French in 1915 against German cities. Later that year, London suffered its first Zeppelin raids, which were followed by attacks by large bomber formations when Britain's air defenses outmatched the huge dirigibles. In turn, British bombers retaliated against Germany. The Italians made the only strategic air raids during World War I, massing large numbers of aircraft to attack a single target, such as the Austro-Hungarian city of Pola on October 22, 1918, the last major air raid of the war. The other warring nations haphazardly bombed each other for revenge and to raise morale in their respective homelands. World War I bombers were crude and clumsy, unable to haul big enough bomb loads for real damage, yet they killed thousands of soldiers and civilians, and more significant to the human psyche, made the very sky that envelops the earth the most dangerous threat to human existence. War movies and television documentaries have made World War II the sine qua non of air warfare. Photographs and films of huge formations of bombers flying through anti-aircraft bursts and whirling enemy fighters to drop tons upon tons of explosives on heavily populated cities. De Terzé's vision fulfilled. Europe pounded to rubble. Japan set on fire and nuked by American B-29s. The pre-World War II terror bombing of Guernica during the Spanish Civil War prompted Picasso's masterpiece, which portrayed the outcry of ordinary citizens against deliberate and indiscriminate death from the sky. Of the 50 or more million human beings who died in the Second World War, a considerable proportion died in bombing attacks. Only the Nazi death camps exceeded the horror of living under the bombs. Germany initiated the slaughter with terror bombings of Guernica and Rotterdam, and by aerial war against Poland in 1939 and England in 1940. The immense air war of World War II can be scaled down to the minuscule, a family cowering in a shelter under a city ravaged by bombs dropped by fleets of airplanes, piloted by determined, frightened crews fighting off winged defenders whose rage and terror match their enemy everywhere in the sky and on the ground, death and burning desolation. Warning of imminent bombing attacks were signaled by shrieking sirens that many still living who experience their sound say chills their blood even now. Anything constructed underground was used for shelter by urban populations, in particular subway tunnels. Bomb shelters, prototypes of later backyard protections against nuclear attack, fortunately never tested, cluttered rural landscapes. The sirens were followed by the deafening drone of aircraft engines and shooting by clustered anti-aircraft batteries, then the impacts and bursts of thousands of bombs, as well as cascading artillery fragments and stricken aircraft. Anyone above ground during the raids would see towering columns of smoke during the days, the glare of firestorms and searchlights at night. Hundreds of thousands of civilians were cremated or suffocated in their shelters in Europe and Asia during World War II. Untold numbers of persons and families disappeared from history. A firestorm caused by incendiary bombs dropped by British aircraft on Hamburg in 1943 killed an estimated 100,000. The beautiful German city of Dresden was unnecessarily destroyed by Allied bombers in 2 days and nights in March 1945. Firebombing of Japan in 1945 incinerated several thousand each raid on its cities by American B-29s. Atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki altered humanity's history and psyche. On March 9, 1945, more than 300 B-29 super fortresses attacked Tokyo, Max Boot wrote in his book, The Savage Wars of Peace, small wars and the rise of American power. Their napalm and magnesium incendiaries turned 16 densely packed square miles into an inferno. An estimated 84,000 people, mostly civilians, were killed, making this one of the deadliest days of warfare ever. And that was Max Boot. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II were carried by large human-piloted aircraft. 75 years later, humanity's awesome arsenal of aerial devastation is primarily telemetric controlled, maintaining only a slippery human hand on the trigger. The world wars left much of the world in ruins, great cities bombed to rubble. European hegemony passed to two rival superpowers that have been allies and victors against Nazism, the United States and Communist Russia. The result was a half-century Cold War with a nuclear arms race that resulted in a hair-trigger balance of terror defended by specious arguments that only nuclear parity would prevent a Third World War. The U.S. and USSR spent hundreds of billions of dollars developing their nuclear arsenals, each posing the threat of the other to continually escalate the race, first with immense squadrons of jet bombers armed with nuclear weapons airborne around the clock in their separate spheres, replaced by underground silos of missiles ready to launch nuclear holocaust at any moment. Each claimed to be defending itself against the other, and the contradictory premise of preventive war, starting a war to prevent a war, was a mutual rationale for threatening world obliteration. The two conflicting and aggressive ideologies derived their power from increasing their arsenals and deceptively concocting treaties that allowed for more and deadlier weapons. At the same time that both superpowers raced through generations of nuclear weapons, both built up their conventional forces and exported weapons, troops, and military aircraft to small wars that erupted all over the globe. Each war was a threat of nuclear confrontation, yet simultaneously these wars skirted oblivion by acting as pressure releases against the big blow. Total warfare insists that all members of a society are participants in a war and are therefore legitimate targets for destruction that justifies bombing of civilian populations, even their nuclear obliteration. Tactical bombing seeks to destroy combatants and their supply lines. Strategic bombing is more complex. Eradication of production and supply is less a goal than erosion of morale, although several surveys indicate that bombing of civilians only increases their stoicism and antipathy toward their attackers, the anonymous flyers who indiscriminately commit mass murder from the stratosphere. A U.S. bombing appraisal committee, which included John Kenneth Galbraith, concluded after World War II that bombing alone would never have sufficiently eroded determined resistance against Allied attack by average German civilians. Galbraith personally thought, as survivors of Allied air raids attested, that bombing actually developed a defiant camaraderie among those bombed on either side of the war. The massive bombing campaign against North Vietnam by the United States proved the same results two decades later. After the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, the United States attacked countries all over the world for one purpose or another, generally from the air with bombs and missiles, and pioneered many of the methods of war from the air and stratosphere. With few exceptions, the USSR in Afghanistan, Israel in its wars, the United States has been the major user of bombs since World War II, which includes nuclear tests. North Korea was blasted and hundreds of thousands of Chinese soldiers napalmed during the 1950-1953 Korean War. More than twice the amount of bombs dropped on Europe during World War II were used on California-sized Vietnam in the decade-long war of the 1960s and 1970s. Civilians in the north made their lives underground, underneath incessant American bombing. North Vietnamese city dwellers, like Londoners a quarter century earlier, evacuated their children to rural areas. The use of bombs and missiles, smart bombs, Patriot missiles, to kill Iraqi soldiers during the first Persian Gulf War of 1991, in particular the Turkish shoot at Iraqis fleeing Kuwait in a massive fleet of tanks, trucks, and cars, evolved directly from the British use of fighters and bombers to wipe out two trapped Turkish divisions in 1918. The Israelis did the same when their Air Force caught a large column of Egyptian armor and soldiers in a narrow pass during the 1967 Seven Days War. The World War II equivalents might be the destruction of Nazi tanks and troops by Allied aircraft in the killing grounds of the so-called Falaise Pocket in France in 1944. And aerial attacks by U.S. naval aircraft on convoys of Japanese troop ships in the Pacific. After the first Gulf War, the U.S. put an iron umbrella over the Middle East to guard its oil lines, striking with aircraft and missiles at targets in countries that disputed its virtual monopoly over their most lucrative regional product. The most startling use of terror from the air in the 21st century so far, if sudden attacks by U.S. Predator drones on Afghan wedding parties are not included, has been the attack on the USA by suicidal commandos who made guided missiles out of hijacked American airliners in a brilliantly horrific scheme of calculated destruction aimed at the empirical cathedrals of American civilization, the World Trade Center in New York City, and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2001, and quite probably the White House by a fourth airliner that crashed short of its target as a result of a revolt by captive passengers against their hijackers. The attack was the second worst death toll on a single day in American history, nearly 3,000 victims. The Civil War Battle of Antietam holds the record at 3,650. For those who carried out the attack, however extremist their theological intent, it was retribution for decades of American bombing. Robert E. Lee said it was probably fortunate that war was so terrible, otherwise we might grow to love it. He had not foreseen its possibilities as video entertainment, such as the two Persian Gulf Wars, provided with wire-guided missiles breaking down doors or falling through factory chimneys. A few cynics predict that future wars will be instigated against poor Southern Hemisphere countries to keep audience ratings high. A video Orwellian scenario of perpetual war using high-tech automated air war stuff, drones and cruise missiles, against everything above ground. Michael S. Sherry wrote a book, The Rise of American Air Power, The Creation of Armageddon, in which he said that, quote, the tension between large hopes and dark fears about the warplane said less about technology or erroneous predictions of air warfare than it did, again the quote, the cultures which would build and use bombers. Although these apocalyptic apprehensions and dreams of deliverance, that's a quote, did not always explain why nations bombed one another, quote, they at least suggest how they would justify bombing or why they sometimes needed little justification at all. The development of the bomber has resulted in the slaughter of millions who might not have died in warfare without its use. Sherry wrote, to treat bombing simply as an abstraction, as a strategy or horrible fantasy or set of statistics, would be to repeat a persistent error in a half century's preoccupation with the bomber, the tendency to regard it, and finally the atomic bomb, as more potent in imagination than its capacity to kill and destroy. And that was Michael Sherry. Perhaps the most inaccurate prediction about the age of the airplane was, as Sven Lindqvist wrote in A History of Bombing, the belief that, quote, flight would do away with the very cause of national conflicts by bringing people closer to one another. Those who had been divisive and hostile on the ground would live peacefully together in the boundless heavens during the age of flight, unquote. I.A.R. Wiley was more balanced in his assessment that airplanes were invented by the Wright brothers some years ago, and when not engaged in killing people, are wont to take them from one place to another. And now, again, something I wrote. Stardust. We burst out of our egg into a history infinitely larger than our own, flung out among rocks and stars that hurtle from the center of a cataclysm at speeds greater than light. Our Earth is a mote from that moment of creation, if indeed that is how the universe began, and it continues to be thrown back to God knows where. We might never know, but we will exhaust the rest of our history attempting to find out. It is doubtful we will more than scratch a few score of the billion stars in our single galaxy before evolution discards us for something else, or we quicken the process by our own perverse ingenuity. We pursue the exploration of space in much the manner our Western European ancestors forced themselves upon the larger world in fierce competition as merchants, mariners, and imperialist colonizers from separate nations in perpetual conflict. We are a species of insatiable plunderers, though of course we tell ourselves we are not, that we seek only knowledge, but our great hunger is for wealth and for what is useful to us. Unless we experience a mass epiphany overnight, we will most likely behave beyond the ozone, the same as our predecessors beyond the oceans. We will pillage planets and hammer space matter until it is functional. We have virtually sucked Earth dry, and our vision of the universe is one of huge orchard of riches. We cover our single planet like maggots on a peach. Our prospects are the stuff of fantastical science fiction. Our only hope might be to send human seedlings off the home planet so that a few might germinate elsewhere, if in all the vast cosmos there is any place else for us. We repeat the old errors. We leave Earth as relentless exploiters. If it was absurd for Europeans to spread across the Earth's oceans and claim foreign lands for kings and countries never heard of by inhabitants of the far shores, how much more so for space-suited humans to plant flags on barren worlds and say they belong in perpetuity to a far distant particle of rock, indistinguishable, if even visible, among the pinprick lights of space. We ought to consider the United Nations as a central agency for space exploration. It would avoid wasteful duplication of resources and wealth consumed by ruthless competition between nations and transnational corporations, and make the bounties of outer space available to the millions of Earthlings who are in need of useful and sustainable work, food, housing, health, medical care, and education. If the idea seems outworldly, it might be useful to remember that UN medical teams eradicated smallpox, with a few military exceptions, and more or less forms the international coalition researching solutions to human-caused anthropogenic global warming. Efficiency must give way to poetry. No machine or computer can view Earth with the same personal response as humans. Earth is, after all, our neighborhood, our nest. It will not be technology that saves us, but our distinct human perceptions. The efforts to go off-planet seem to have little to do with the rest of day-to-day humanity. Yet our era makes the first baby steps of an adventure that will occupy humanity the rest of its time in the cosmos. We might be the last generations of humans to be a single-planet species. One world history and philosophy will be mere prelude to the immense galactic story that awaits our bumbling, erratic first paragraph. An age is superseding an earlier one right under our feet, or more truthfully, over our heads. And perhaps it might be worth considering that it is not our divine right to eat the Milky Way. A personal note. My late father, William Copeland McCusker, spent much of World War II as an air raid warden in Los Angeles, California, which might seem funny now, 75 years after the war ended, but history is not a foregone conclusion. My father protected his neighborhood in an era when cities all over the world were under attack from the air. Untold millions died under the bombs. Hundreds of thousands of men and women were air raid wardens in their cities and neighborhoods like my father, and many thousands died in air raids on both sides of the war. The fear after Pearl Harbor, 10 days ago in 1941, was that if the Japanese could reach across the Pacific Ocean and strike at the U.S. Navy in Hawaii, they could also mount a bombing offensive on Pacific Coast cities on the American mainland. A Japanese strike at War Industries in Los Angeles, in particular the many aircraft factories, as well as shipyards in Oregon and Washington on the Columbia River, was a realistic prospect in the early months and years of the war. My father, whose specialty was a thorough knowledge of emergency medical care at the time, was well placed in civil defense. He was always on call from the Red Cross in war and peace. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schulk is the engineer for this program. Now we have a first vaccine after 300,000 Americans have died in this current world war against an invading virus, half the number who died in the USA in a similar pandemic a century ago. Although America's commander-in-chief has been AWOL, once again a deserter as he was during the Vietnam War, he clamors for recognition as the nation's savior from the enemy pestilence. While the plague ravaged American states and cities as a direct result of Donald Trump's deceitful decrepitude, he has instead incited a civil insurrection to remain in dictatorial power that has been incredibly dysfunctional and despicable. Every medical person on the front lines of this nearly year-long pandemic, especially those who have sickened and died in the line of duty, deserves a tribute equivalent to medals of valor and honor. But this is not indeed the beginning of the end, but simply the end of the beginning, to rephrase Winston Churchill. There is yet a long period of months before enough vaccine or vaccines is available and everybody eventually vaccinated. So although hope is arriving, the war against the coronavirus is yet to be won. Do not let down your guards. Continue to mask up and lock down. And remember, protecting yourself protects everybody else. Happy kissing star solstice.